From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Paul Schrader's movies have provoked their share of controversy. Schrader wrote the screenplay for the films Taxi Driver and The Last Temptation of Christ, both directed by Martin Scorsese. Schrader's sure to face controversy again with the film he's just directed, Patty Hearst. On this edition of Fresh Air, we feature the first in a two-part interview with Paul Schrader. We also meet writer Clarence Major, one of the few black American novelists writing experimental fiction. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz still remembers that time singers Ethel Merman and Mary Martin appeared together on TV. Now that vintage performance is out on home video, and Lloyd has a review. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. Sin and redemption are recurring themes in the work of filmmaker Paul Schrader. So it was a logical choice when director Martin Scorsese asked Schrader to write the screenplay for The Last Temptation of Christ. Scorsese had already directed Schrader's screenplays for Taxi Driver and Raging Bull. The Last Temptation of Christ has aroused angry protests by some Christian fundamentalists who object to scenes that portray Christ as having human desires and weaknesses. The protesters might be surprised to learn that Schrader was brought up in a very religious, Calvinist home. In fact, as a young man, he had planned to become a minister. Movies were banned by his church, and it wasn't until he was a teenager that he went to a movie theater. He loved the movies, and instead of entering the ministry, he became a film critic, then a screenwriter, then a director. He wrote and directed the films Blue Collar, Hardcore, American Gigolo, Mishima, and Light of Day. Schrader also directed the new film Patty Hearst, which opens September 23rd. The movie is based on Hearst's memoir about her abduction by the radical cult group the Symbionese Liberation Army. Hearst is played by Natasha Richardson, the daughter of Vanessa Redgrave and Tony Richardson. We have a two-part interview with Paul Schrader. Tomorrow, we'll discuss his religious background and his early films. Today, we focus on his two new films, The Last Temptation of Christ and Patty Hearst. Schrader didn't initiate the Patty Hearst movie. I asked him what interested him in the project.
I've always liked films and gotten involved with films that take a particular point of view and follow it to its logical or illogical conclusion and doesn't wink at the audience or indicate to the audience. And these films, often the point of view is of someone that is socially marginal, you know, be it a psychopathic cab driver, a suicidal Japanese novelist, a thug boxer, a gigolo, in fact, Christ himself. And just take that point of view and see where it leads. And what interested me about the script was that it was from her point of view and that there were no cutaways to the family or to the police. And the moment I started thinking about what her point of view would be, I had to come to terms with the fact that for the first 6 weeks, she was in a closet blindfolded. And so that the world wasn't really the world that she imagined because she couldn't see it. And...
Well, describe how you filmically solve the problem there of telling the story from the perspective of someone who was blindfolded.
Well, you know, I think the film deals with, during that section, psychological states of place rather than physical states of place. To put it another way, you know, it's surreal. It is the world that... a kind of horrific world that might be imagined, not necessarily by her, but by the filmmaker.
The story of Patty Hearst really captured the attention of the public. I wonder if you got caught up in it at the time or not.
Well, certainly. You know, it was Polaroid folklore. it was on every day and everywhere you went. People said, you know, what do you think of Patty Hearst? I did not imagine it being a film. And I don't think I would have ever written a script on this material because it violates the central commercial tenet of movie making, which is one of the reasons it was a rather difficult film to make.
What's that tenet?
Is that we go to movies, I believe, to see people take charge of things. Basically, since we can't really control our own lives, we go to movies and see people who do. And Patty Hearst did not take control of her life. She did not act. She was acted upon. She is a passive protagonist. And, you know, had she ever tried to escape, or had she been killed, or, you know, taken some more active role in this drama, it would have been a normal movie. And I think the reason it was never made was that, you know, how do you lick this problem of a passive protagonist? Because you have to start building the movie around your protagonist rather than letting your protagonist pull the movie with him or her.
Mm-hmm. Paul Schrader is my guest, and he directed the new movie Patty Hearst, which is about to open, and he also wrote the screenplay for The Last Temptation of Christ. You actually, I think, met with Patty Hearst, and she gave you several pages of notes after she read the screenplay. Did she tell you anything that you were able to use?
Yeah, I didn't really meet with her. I gave her a phone call. I said, you know, if you have any comments on the script, please send them to me now rather than afterward, because I can't do anything about them afterward. So she sent me about a 12-page memo that I found remarkably objective and dealing primarily with matters of fact, you know. This wouldn't have happened that way. He wouldn't have said that. And then several, some of her feelings, which were incorporated into her final speech in the film.
Okay. Did she challenge anything? Well, I guess you hadn't written the script anyway, so.
Yeah. But no, I mean, you know, she understood the process. She had sold the rights to her book. A script had been written. And you know, the train was starting to leave the station, and she couldn't stop it. So she made comments.
I'm sure everybody wants to know if you think that she was brainwashed or not.
Well, yeah, I mean, she now says that that was the case. You know, for a number of years, she tried to sort of pretend it wasn't. But, you know, if it looks like a cow and walks like a cow, it's a cow. And in this case, it's brainwashing. And it doesn't take 57 days to do that. You know, the U.S. military has done some testing, and they estimate that for a soldier, it's 8 to 10 days of this kind of passive coercion can turn a soldier around. And so, you know, it's not that unusual or spectacular a thing to be brainwashed. You know, let me put you in a closet with a bunch of threatening people for a week or two, and we'll see what happens.
You cast people who were pretty unknown in the movie world in the film Patty Hearst. And your previous film, Light of Day, starred two very well-known people, the actor Michael J. Fox and the rock star Joan Jett. I was wondering if your experiences working with them led you at all to work with people who were lesser known in your new movie.
No, I just wanted a sense of freshness so that you could sort of look at the film without bringing all the baggage of previous film associations.
This is, in a way, a film about being transformed by radical politics. Whether or not Patty Hearst was brainwashed, certainly the people who joined the SLA changed their names, overcame their middle-class identities, which they didn't want anymore. As the movie points out, a couple of them really wished that they were black. And you really describe the theater of radical politics in the movie and the effect of that in transforming people's identities. And I was wondering if that kind of radicalism ever had a similar appeal to you.
Well, I think it's important to remember about the SLA that they are not reflective of any responsible political group, no matter how far you go to the left.
Yeah, well, they're kind of where this paranoid schizophrenic fringe meets radical politics.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's closer to the Jonestown crowd, which came out of Oakland, came out of the same area about 6 months later. In my mind, the SLA has more connections with cult than with politics.
Mm-hmm.
And they had no constituency, and they had no real credentials. Now, I just sort of said that. I forgot what the question was.
Oh, about being transformed by rhetoric and radical politics, by looking at it as a kind of theater.
Yeah, I mean, they were transformed by a number of things. They were, you know, one of the underlying things that to really understand this particular group is that they were all genuine Negrophiles. And they spoke in black street dialect. You know, there's two things underneath it. One was a strong lesbian kind of feminism, and another was this desire to be black revolutionaries, white middle-class kids who want to be black revolutionaries. And in fact, when I was doing the rehearsals for the film, the cast all spoke in this kind of ersatz black street dialect, and it was just so, maybe not racist, but it was so kind of caricatured that I just knew I couldn't do it on the screen, even though that's how they actually spoke.
Hmm. Did you have the temptation to do any rewriting, since you've written so many screenplays yourself? This is when you were directing, that you didn't write yourself?
Well, I did a few things, I added narration, but basically I abided by the script, and I liked the script, and I wanted to work right away, and I didn't want to, stop the whole process and sit down and rewrite the movie. And so I just added some things that that helped me out, and the foremost of that was the narration.
How did this experience leave you feeling about taking on movies that you didn't initiate yourself?
Well, it's I like it. I came up in the film school generation when this idea of the writer-director was sacrosanct. And I don't really believe that much anymore. I think it's a valuable creative friction in the wedding of a writer and a director. And I think the way that Scorsese and I have worked on those three films is actually very good for both of us. And so I'm moving away from this notion of the writer-director. And in fact, I did a film called Light of Day, and I think the film was hurt by me being both writer and director.
How so?
Well, I think the writer in me was holding back the director, and the director was trying to protect the writer. And if they had been different people, there would have been a feistier exchange, which would have helped the film.
Well, you mentioned your collaborative relationship with Martin Scorsese. He asked you to write the screenplay for The Last Temptation of Christ, and based on Kazantzakis' book.
Right.
Now, redemption, sin have always been themes in your movies, but did you want to take on those themes as directly as you had to do to actually write about Jesus?
Well, Marty has said something to this effect, too, that when you've been dealing in metaphorical ways with the issues of sin and guilt and redemption, it's pretty irresistible to pass up the opportunity to deal with the original item.
Did you share Kazantzakis' vision of Jesus as humanity?
Yeah, well, I mean, the goal was to adapt the book, and that essentially what is on screen is Kazantzakis' vision. Everyone says it's Scorsese's Christ and so forth, but Marty will be the first to tell you that the overriding vision of the film is Kazantzakis. And one of the things that I am most proud of in the film is that it is, I believe, very both a good movie and faithful to a good book, which is a rare combination.
Scorsese is from a Roman Catholic Italian New York background. You're from a Calvinist small town Midwest background. And I was wondering if your backgrounds, especially your different religious backgrounds, Protestant versus Catholic, affected the way you wanted to see Christ portrayed visually or verbally on the screen.
Yeah, well, this collaboration, because before this film we did Taxi Driver and Raging Bull.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's a nice kind of friction there, because we both are very morally grounded and both have the same kind of religious beliefs, but we're culturally different, and so it creates a very felicitous friction. And then that is, again, doubled in the case of Last Temptation, because you're adapting a book which is basically from a Greek Orthodox background. And one of the nice things about the film is this kind of layer cake of theological perspectives.
Mm-hmm. So is there an example of Of something that you both felt should be represented differently because of your backgrounds?
You know, like the book, Kanzaki was not only sort of influenced by Nietzsche and Calvin and all the sort of Protestant thinkers, but also heavily influenced by the East I'm trying to find a way to make it sound simple, just basically mysticism. And when I adapted the book, I felt much more comfortable with the Nietzschean aspects than with the Eastern aspects. So I started moving the script that way. And then when Marty adapts the script into a film, he feels more comfortable with Catholic visual iconography than, with Protestant or Greek Orthodox. And so you see a shift, each time it changes hands. And what keeps it from falling apart is that each set of hands is an interesting set of hands.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk with you more about your work and also about your life, but first we're going to take a short break. Paul Schrader is my guest, and he wrote the screenplay for The Last Temptation of Christ and also directed the forthcoming film Patty Hearst. His other film credits include the screenplays for Taxi Driver and Raging Bull, which were both directed by Martin Scorsese. And Schrader also wrote and directed Hardcore, Blue Collar, American Gigolo, and Light of Day. He's joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Screenwriter and director Paul Schrader is my guest. Let's talk some more about Last Temptation of Christ. You started the screenplay for this in 1981, and I understand that there was a clause in your contract that said if the movie wasn't shot within 6 years, you would get the next opportunity at directing it if Scorsese hadn't already begun work on it. How would you have directed Last Temptation of Christ differently?
Well, first of all, that's a little incorrect.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It took 6 years to get the film made, but I had just said that if Marty ever decides not to make the film, I have to be given a chance to raise the money to make it for myself.
Oh, I see. So it wasn't anything as explicit as 6 years.
Right.
Okay. How would you have directed it differently?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I mean, you can waste a lot of time in this life thinking about things that don't happen, and I choose not to. I just assume I would have directed it differently, but I'm not going to sit down and figure out how, since I never had the opportunity.
The words of Christ and Judas are written in contemporary vernacular. How much of that is you and how much of that is Kazantzakis?
Well, Kazantzakis wrote the original script in a dialect so that he could be slangy.
Mm-hmm.
And because, he felt the same limitations that anyone would feel in dealing with the scriptures, because people remember this King James English, and you can't make a film in Aramaic. So that you don't want to make it in King James English, because that's just certainly incorrect. And you don't want to make it in Aramaic, because no one will understand it. So you have to find some way to make it sound fresh. And that means you just have to bite the bullet and use vernacular.
Well, instead of live by the sword, you die by the sword, it's you wrote, you live by this, you die by this.
Yeah. A lot of the dialogue was changed by by Scorsese. And I think, basically because it isn't in Aramaic, but it is in street English, it will always sound wrong. And in the end, when he's directing the movie, he's more comfortable with his version of how it sounds wrong than someone else's version of how it sounds wrong. So it keeps getting changed.
What was your version of how that sounded wrong?
My version was a little more poetic. It was a little, a little more florid than his version.
Do you remember it?
Yeah, I mean, when you're writing on the page, it's always a different thing, and you tend to write speeches, and when you're directing, you tend to direct conversations. So part of that is the process in all films. But I have a memory that my script was a little more purple than the movie.
Could you recite any of it?
No.
Okay.
I mean, the lines that stand out to me, the ones I remember, are the ones that are still in the movie, you know.
Mm-hmm, such as?
Well, like, you know, Judas's final speech to Jesus when he says, you know, I loved you, we had the world in our hands. And, you know, that kind of impassioned dialogue. And the exchange between Jesus and Judas when he says that, you know, you're the only one who's strong enough to betray me, and that kind of stuff. It was more along those lines. But I have absolutely no complaint about this. That is not only part of a director's prerogative, it's part of his mandate.
Was the screenplay toned down from the original version? I believe you wrote about two drafts, and then there were several drafts after that. Was the screenplay consciously toned down because of the controversy?
Not much. Certainly not because of the controversy. In the original novel, Paul stones Mary Magdalene to death. And that was, you know, Marty just said to me, he said, with everything else I'm doing, I just can't have St. Paul stone a pregnant woman to death. So you know, that was like a toning down decision. And some of the sexual language may have been pulled back a little, but not any more than the sort of changes that are made on any of our collaborations.
Did you expect this degree of controversy when you started working on the film?
Not when I started writing it, because I'd come from a conservative religious background that was rather intellectual, so I was used to kind of intense theological argument. But then in 83, when the evangelicals blocked the film from being made at Paramount, we knew it was coming.
Did you feel that you understood the protesters at all because of the religious background you were from?
Some of them. And you know, and I know some of them, and I've been doing some interviews with the religious press. But you also have to understand that the debate was originally framed by the evangelical right, and it was framed in such a way that the conservative Christian middle got dragged into the fray. And then when the film came out, which is why the film had to be rushed out, a lot of Christians in the conservative middle found themselves rather uncomfortable, having previously allied themselves with the evangelical right on this. And so there's been a kind of a readjusting of those attitudes.
Were you ever the slightest bit concerned yourself that it might be a sin to write this way about Jesus?
No, I mean, you know, there's an element of anti-intellectualism in all of this. And just because you need the faith of a child to enter into the kingdom of heaven doesn't mean you have to have the mind of a child. And it is possible to be an intelligent, questioning person and still have faith. And if I remember correctly, the Protestant Reformation was about exactly this point. And there is nothing wrong with this kind of theological argument. And certainly this argument, the dual nature of Christ, is the most central to to Christianity itself.
Did writing the screenplay bring you back to reading the Old and New Testaments?
Yeah, well, it threw me back, obviously, not only into the historical research, but also into the evolving theology of the nature of Christ.
Now, there used to be a ban in your church against seeing movies. Does that ban still exist?
No. I think that they have made that a matter of individual conscience now. The ban actually began in the 1920s as a result of the way theater was headed at that time.
So people you know from your hometown could have seen the movie?
Yes, I think it is now a matter of individual conscience. It used to be a synodical decree, but I think that's been done away with.
Filmmaker Paul Schrader is my guest. I want to ask you a couple of other things about working with Marty Scorsese, since you've made several films with him, Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, The Last Temptation of Christ. Do your temperaments match? You know, we talked earlier about you being from a small town background, you being Protestant, and he being from New York City, Italian, Roman Catholic. When you're actually collaborating on a movie, do you bring a different kind of temperament, a different kind of pacing to it?
Yeah, I mean, we're both real feisty and opinionated, and we can't really collaborate in the same room. You know, it would very quickly degenerate into some kind of squabble. So basically, you know, he doesn't bother me when I write, and I don't bother him when he directs. You know, there's a communication that is very deep and very understood, but it's not two people working over a desk. And it was sort of funny because I was talking to Richard Price, who had written Color of Money with Marty. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, when I read your script of Temptation, I couldn't imagine how it would appear on screen. And I said, that's the opposite thing I felt, because when I saw the film, I was not surprised one iota by anything. I just sat there watching it, and I said, okay, now he's done that, now he's going to do this, now he's going to do that. And I knew exactly what it would look like, even though I had not seen any of the film and hadn't talked to Marty about it in years. And so there is an underlying sympathy that we share.
You wrote The Last Temptation of Christ. You wrote the first draft of it 7 years ago, back in 1981. The film is causing so much controversy now in the United States. How attached do you feel to it?
Very much. I mean, you know, I think it's a terrific novel, and I'm very proud of the script, very proud of the movie. And, as we discussed earlier, it's a script that if, for any reason, Marty had not made, I would have made.
Do you find other people want to come and talk theology with you?
Yes. Yes, they do.
Is that good or bad?
Well, it can get a little draining.
Two of your screenplays have starred Robert De Niro, Raging Bull, and Taxi Driver, and he was supposed to, I believe, play Christ in The Last Temptation. Mm-hmm. What was the reason why he didn't finally play the role?
Well, the way he said it to me was he just said that no one will believe me in a sheet.
No one would believe him in a sheet?
Yes. Uh-huh. He just didn't think he could play the period, you know. I think he was wrong, but, obviously he has to go by his own instincts.
What films do you have in the works now?
Well, I just finished writing an original script, a big love story. I wrote a script years ago that Brian De Palma made into a film called Obsession. Mm-hmm. And I've always wanted to write a script like that for myself, one of those undying love stories. This one is called Forever Mine. And so I did that this summer and wrote one of endless love.
Paul Schrader wrote the screenplay for The Last Temptation of Christ. His new film, Patty Hearst, opens on September 23rd. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, part two of our interview with Paul Schrader, he'll discuss his religious upbringing, his decision to go into filmmaking instead of the ministry, and we'll talk about his early films, including Taxi Driver. I hope you can join us.
Listen, you screwheads. Here's a man who would not take it anymore. A man who stood up against the scum, the dogs, the filth. Here is someone who stood up. Now I see it clearly. My whole life has pointed in one direction. I see that now. There never has been any choice for me.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring a removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Clarence Major's recent novel, Such Was the Season, was about a northern black intellectual who returns to visit his home in the South. The subject of Major's new novel is further removed from his own background. It's about Navajo culture. Coming up, Clarence Major discusses the response he used to get from some fellow black writers who said his experimental fiction wasn't political enough. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the home video of the Ford 50th anniversary show. It was during that celebrated TV broadcast that Ethel Merman and Mary Martin sang their dazzling 12-minute duet. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg explains how John Wayne helped teach him Italian. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The Securities and Exchange Commission today charged the investment banking firm Drexel Burnham Lambert with federal securities violations, including illegal insider trading. The charges against the firm and several individuals were filed today in federal court in New York. Vice President George Bush took one of his most familiar criticisms of Michael Dukakis to the American Legion today. The Bush campaign contended that Dukakis's defense policy would have prevented the most significant arms control achievement of this decade. NPR's Jim Angle reports.
Vice President Bush today accused Governor Dukakis of pursuing what amounts to an undeclared unilateral nuclear freeze. Bush suggested Dukakis's opposition to the MX and Midget Man missiles and other weapon systems would leave America at a disadvantage and reduce the prospects for future arms reductions between the U.S. and the Soviet Union.
Now, I favor these elements in our modernization program for a simple reason. If the Soviets think that an American president will unilaterally gut our weapons modernization program, they will have absolutely no incentive to negotiate reduction.
In a reference to Dukakis's reputation for being tight-fisted, Bush said if his opponent doesn't want to modernize his snowblower, that's his business. But if he doesn't want to modernize our defenses, that's dangerous business for America. I'm Jim Angle with the Bush campaign in Louisville, Kentucky.
Michael Dukakis today outlined a college assistance program that would ensure repayment of college loans by automatically deducting payments from students' future earnings. Dukakis criticized the Reagan administration for cutting back programs that helped qualified middle class and poor students get through college. He accused George Bush of doing nothing to prevent the program reductions. Congress came back to Washington today, and though there's a long list of legislation still on the lawmakers' agenda, NPR's Cokie Roberts reports that the election ahead is what's on their minds.
When Congress recessed 3 weeks ago for the Republican convention and summer vacation, Democrats were riding high. They judged their convention a success, and their presidential candidate enjoyed a wide lead in the polls. Now, the Democrats have returned with some sense of pessimism about November, as George Bush has risen in the polls and shown himself to be a much more formidable campaigner than they had expected. Republicans are delighted with what they see as the change in their candidate and are beginning to believe that victory in November might once again be theirs. And both Democrats and Republicans seem somewhat baffled by Michael Dukakis. They don't understand why the Democratic nominee seems to have allowed the Republicans to define him as a Massachusetts liberal without fighting back. But both sides are cautious about making any predictions at this stage of the game, preferring to fall back on the conclusion that this will be a very close election. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
President Reagan has invited the foreign ministers of Israel and Egypt to meet with him later this month in New York during the annual meeting of the United Nations General Assembly. An Israeli foreign ministry spokesman revealed the joint invitation today in Jerusalem. According to Reuters, Israel's Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir is not happy with the timing of the invitation. It comes at the start of campaigning by Shamir and Foreign Minister Shimon Peres for Israel's November 1st general election. The biggest lottery jackpot in North American history was claimed today by a woman from Winter Springs, Florida. Florida lottery officials declared Sheila Ryan the winner of the record $55.1 million jackpot. Ryan claimed the windfall prize on a purchase of $5 worth of lottery tickets. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose less than a point to close at 2065.79. Advances led declines 7-6 in trading of 139 million shares. Average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 4 cents. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Ethel Merman and Mary Martin are two of the greatest stars of the American musical stage. 35 years ago, they teamed up to sing on one of the most celebrated live specials on early TV. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz, who was a mere youngster at the time, watched the show. It's available now on a new home video cassette. Lloyd says it's just as good the second time around.
There's no business like show business, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing, everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling.
Through reruns, TV series from the 50s and 60s have won new followings. Cable and local stations have given Burns and Allen, Car 54, Where Are You?, Perry Mason, and Your Show of Shows new leases on life. But the one-shot live TV specials are almost never rebroadcast. In many cases, that's probably no great loss. The so-called spectaculars were often spectacular duds. But at least one show remains cherished in some people's memories. The Ford 50th Anniversary Show, a two-hour variety program broadcast on June 15, 1953, and as far as I know, never repeated. The highlight of that program was a 12-minute duet, a medley of songs sung by two of the greatest musical comedy stars of all time, Ethel Merman and Mary Martin. Maybe the only time they ever performed together in public. It was staged and conceived by choreographer Jerome Robbins and put together with a wit and cleverness and affection that you don't often associate with television. Immediately after the telecast, Decca Records put out a little 10-inch LP of the duet, but it wasn't in print long. I've seen tantalizing snippets of the medley on documentaries, but now Lyric Distribution has put out a budget-price videotape of the entire program. The duet certainly holds up. Merman and Martin are at the top of their form, and they obviously loved working together. Merman's brashness and Martin's sweet sensitivity are miraculously complementary, and we even get a taste of Martin's brashness and Merman's sensitivity. The medley begins with a couple of the standards they themselves introduced— Merman's There's No Business Like Show Business, and Martin's Wonderful Guy from South Pacific. Then they greet each other, and the medley takes off.
Hi, Ethel.
Hiya, Mary.
How about singing some old songs?
I think that'd be fun.
Good.
By the light of the silvery moon, I want a spoon to my honey I'll croon love to.
Don't let me hear you make a smile.
I'm the Sheik of Araby. Your love belongs to me. At night when you're asleep, into your tent I'll creep.
When the red robin goes bop, bop, bobbing along,
I love Merman vamping the camera with her saucer eyes in The Sheik of Araby. This segues into a comical series of I songs. I'm in the mood for love. I love a parade. I'd climb the highest mountain. I'm sitting on top of the world. I've got a feeling you're fooling. They tease each other and one-up each other, and their voices blend as if they were made for each other. Here they are singing rings around Tea for Two.
I'm calling to you upon my knees, tea for two and two for tea.
Will you answer
me for two when you won't be alone? Nobody near us to see us, to hear us, to friends or relations, or weekend vacations. We won't have it known, dear, that we all are down alone, dear. Don't know why.
They end, together, with a reprise of There's No Business Like Show Business that's surprisingly moving. Maybe there really is no business like it. The rest of the show has its moments, too, especially the stirring renditions of He's Got the Whole World in His Hands and a verse from the Battle Hymn of the Republic sung by the magnificent Marian Anderson. Co-hosts Oscar Hammerstein and Edward R. Murrow and sponsor Henry Ford pontificate ponderously, but it's oddly moving to hear that at least some people in the 50s were actually worried about the past and the future. This tape doesn't seem to be available in stores, but you can call this 800 number for information, 1-800-777-5444.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the lyric distribution video cassette of the Ford 50th Anniversary Show. This is Fresh Air. Clarence Major is one of the few black writers known for experimental fiction and poetry. His last two novels, Such Was the Season and Painted Turtle, are a departure from Major. They're more narrative and may bring him a wider readership. Such Was the Season is about a middle-aged black intellectual with an identity crisis who returns home to the South for a visit. Such Was the Season isn't narrated by the intellectual, who has more in common with Major, but is told through the voice of the Southern aunt, Annie Eliza, who grew up poor and uneducated.
I grew up with people, my mother, for example, and her sisters, and all the elderly women in the neighborhoods I ever lived in. I think Annie Eliza is put together out of all of that mosaic of people, you know, of elderly black women. I know them like I know myself. And I thought they had, you know, that they really were a kind of cornerstone to the communities, and they were very valuable as preservers of culture and history and so on. And all it was very important. And something else too, I think is often denied. Black Americans have a legacy of you know that goes back to Africa of having a very matriarchal way of thinking and living. And I think what I wanted to do was to look at a set of experiences from the point of view of someone who was old enough to remember that legacy, which is, of course, has been receding and dying over the last 50 years or so.
Your new novel, Painted Turtle, Woman with Guitar, is about Indians in the Southwest. I was surprised when I picked up this book and found out that it was about Native Americans. So I had to ask myself, why were you writing from the perspective of Native Americans? And if, you know, was there any Native American blood in your family?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Cherokees. But that's not the main reason I got interested in this. The main reason has to do with the fact that I live in Colorado. And I've lived there for 11 years. And I spent a lot of time in the Southwest, in New Mexico and Arizona, and around reservations and so on. I got very interested in just looking at the cultures down there and these people who had been there for thousands of years.
I'm going to ask you to read a passage from your new novel. And I don't know if you'd like to set it up at all before you start the reading.
Well, let me see. It's actually a novel told by a young Navajo who's in love with a Zuni woman. And he's lovingly telling the story of her life, making it up literally, you know, in this magical way, and telling how ultimately she transformed him and brought him around to seeing some of her own values, which were, in the end, morally superior to his own. If you're a man, it's hard to always know exactly how to write about a woman, even as a girl growing up. Yet you must try your best. You can see she didn't have much time to play with dolls. There were her little brother and sisters, perfect dolls with real diapers, and the trouble of herself. She had diarrhea and toothache. Even as she played tag and jacks, she had to look forward to emptying the morning slop jar, helping to scrub the floor, fry the mutton, clean the skillets, slice the onions. Winter cold drove itself through the logs like nothing you can think of in the Southwest. They say a woman's body is warmer than a man's. Don't believe it. I lay beside her many nights when she was grown. I was warm and she was cold. Did she color in coloring books by the stove in the deep of winter? She did. She wanted to be a boy. Little wonder. Boys at Zuni could look forward to initiation. After that, after the visit with the men to the kivas, they stepped up into daylight like gods born out of the ashes of the dead.
The beginning of that passage really reminds me of your plight as a writer. The character in the book describes how difficult it is for a man to describe a woman. And you're making up lots of characters and describing them, but in this instance, you're describing a whole culture that isn't your own. Was that quite a challenge to take on?
Absolutely, yes. And I like that challenge, that sort of challenge, and for the same reason that I liked Anna Eliza as a challenge, you know, the gender thing, putting myself in the place of a woman. But the main reason I like the challenge is because I don't like to do the same thing over and over.
Your last two novels, this one, Painted Turtle, and your previous one, Such Was the Season, are much more narrative-oriented than some of your previous work, which was more experimental.
Right.
Was that a conscious thing to become more narrative in your fiction?
I think by the time I wrote Such Was the Season, I was interested in that voice as an experiment, one that I had never tried.
And the voice of the ant.
Yeah, and for me, it was just as experimental as anything I'd ever done, although it comes off as looking more conventional to someone who's familiar with my work, you know, and I've even had people say, oh, Clarence has sold out, you know, he's writing straight novels. But that's not the case at all. In fact, some reviewers, one in the Washington Post, for example, thought that it was an exact continuation of the earlier experiments.
I want to read you a quote from Such Was the Season and see if this something similar has applied to you in any way. There's a scene where June Boy, who is the northern scientist who goes down to the south to visit his aunt, is taken to a party, and there he meets the mayor. And the mayor says to him, I admire your work about sickle cell anemia, but what we black people need are strong, lasting families. I was wondering if you ever got something similar from people. I admire your experimental writing, but what we black people need are good, inspirational stories.
Oh, yes, especially back in the 60s when I was going around a lot of college campuses, and my work wasn't thought of as particularly relevant because it wasn't strongly nationalistic and politically obvious. So I got a lot of that criticism.
In 1970, you edited an encyclopedia of Afro-American slang. it's something that, at least in our conversation, you don't use much of. And it's interesting to me that you'd be this interested in slang, yet not really necessarily use it yourself in speech.
And that's slangy.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I can be slangy. I don't choose to be. I think, you know, what can I say? Basically, you talk the way you talk when it's appropriate.
What interests you in slang, the way language changes?
I was interested in how the language, evolving language in the Black community, was also a kind of gesture of rebellion and a kind of attempt to preserve Black culture and to assert it. Of course, I mean, there have been other people who've done so much more work in that area than I've ever done. You know, I'm not a scholar in that sense, but I was interested in how the language evolves as protest as well.
Are you working on a new novel now?
Yes. I just finished a big novel, my biggest, most ambitious book, called Solid Ground. And it's set in Venice, Italy, but it moves all over the place. It's set in the South. It's set in Athens, Georgia, in Atlanta, Chicago, New York. It starts in the 30s, and it moves up to the 80s.
It should give you a lot of voices to capture.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Writer Clarence Major, his latest books are Such Was the Season, published by Mercury House, and Painted Turtle, published by Sun and Moon Press. This semester, he's teaching in the creative writing program at Temple University. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Renee Montaigne. Hi, Renee.
Hello.
I'll bet you're on the campaign trail.
Yes, Linda Wertheimer and Jim Angle certainly are, and they'll have reports for us today. George Bush spoke to the American Legion, and he made a bit of a gaffe. He repeatedly referred to today as Pearl Harbor Day. He's right in one way. It is the 7th of the month, but Pearl Harbor Day doesn't come around until December 7th. Michael Dukakis unveiled his new campaign commercials.
What about the world beyond the candidates?
Well, beyond the candidates, at least in some parts of the world, things are a little troublesome. Yellowstone National Park has been closed. They announced that today because fires there are making it so dangerous. And we talked to an environmentalist from World Watch Institute about the floods in Bangladesh.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. American TV viewers have long puzzled at those Japanese science fiction movies that are dubbed into English. But our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg, says he once learned a whole new language from dubbed films.
There are a lot of reasons for the success of English as a world language, but some credit certainly should go to Hollywood. From Singapore to Paris to Buenos Aires, millions of people have taken their first English lessons from Humphrey Bogart and John Wayne, or in the case of my French-born wife, from Casper the Friendly Ghost. But I have rather a special claim to fame. Bogart and Wayne taught me Italian. This was in 1978, when I was hanging around Rome with a Fulbright fellowship in my pocket and a lot of time on my hands. I didn't know enough Italian to follow Italian movies, so I wound up spending a lot of evenings going to American movies that were dubbed in Italian. These I could follow, since I'd seen them all before. In fact, I soon learned a number of useful Italian expressions. I might not know how to ask for the bus to the stazione, but I knew how to say, "We'll always have Paris." At first, I confess, I found it a little unsettling watching Humphrey Bogart turn to Dooley Wilson in Casablanca and say in this deep Roman voice, "Suonala, Sam." The Italians always used actors with deep voices to dub the heroes of American films, which often sounded funny because very few of our great macho actors have had macho voices. I suppose the Italians would have laughed if anybody had tried to dub Bogart with a realistic lisp or tried to replicate John Wayne's stammering, creaky tenor. After a while, though, the dubbing didn't disconcert me so much anymore. Most people who go to foreign language films in America have a horror of dubbing, as if the whole filmic experience is ruined if they can't hear the actors reciting their lines in the original Czech or Hindi. But actually, you get less out of that authenticity than you might suppose. We have a vivid memory of the voices of English-speaking actors, for example. But can you recall the voices of actors whom you've only heard speaking a language that you don't know, say Gerard Depardieu or Ugo Tognazzi or Brigitte Bardot? Most people can't. It's hard to make anything of a voice when you don't understand the language being spoken. I doubt if the Italians would have appreciated the unusual quality of Bogart's voice, even if they had seen the film with the original soundtrack. Dubbing has another virtue when it's done the Italian way. As it happens, the Italians dub all their films, even the ones with Italian actors. As a result, they don't listen to movie dialogue the way we do, as a recording of what the actors are actually saying as they're being filmed. They tend to think of the voices they hear as a kind of oral subtitle, as if the dialogue were being recited by other actors standing outside the frame. For this reason, they don't think of foreign language films as an exotic entertainment. Italy is a country where ordinary people actually go to see movies made abroad. In fact, the Italian attitude toward foreign films is much closer to what things must have been like in the days before sound, when film relied on action, not language, to make its point. It was only after I'd been living in Italy for a while that I came to appreciate what the great silent directors like Eisenstein were getting at when they said that sound would be the end of the cinema as a genuinely universal art form. Now, I realize that we're not about to adopt the Italian system here. To make it work, you'd have to dub everybody in English, not just Mastroianni and Deneuve, but Barbara Streisand and Woody Allen, too. And I don't imagine people would be willing to put up with that. On the other hand, think what the procedure might do for Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California.
No one can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers as time goes by.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time we meet Joey Ramone, the lead singer of the Ramones. The Ramones were one of the first and most influential punk rock groups of the mid-70s. The band's still together, and they have a new double album retrospective. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews A Vision Shared, the new album of rock stars as diverse as Little Richard and Bruce Springsteen, singing the songs of Woody Guthrie and Leadbelly. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Moon Over Parador, the new comedy starring Richard Dreyfuss, Raul Julia, and Sonia Braga. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.